Okay, a few things I wanted to say a bit more about this approach of anatta. So just from my experience of doing it again this morning, one of the things I notice is that a lot of it is you just need to trust the view, if you see. Just trust the view, just keep coming back to disidentifying with experience. And just trust that will have an effect. Again, it's very easy to start looking for results. As soon as you look for results, you're not really doing it. You're not actually doing the practice. So what I noticed this morning, I needed to just completely trust, okay, well, I'll just come back to that reflection. And you don't need to make a big deal of it. As I've said before, it easily gets too heady and kind of like you're chasing self around and trying to get rid of it, like things, you know, like things popping up and you keep on trying to press each one down. It's easy to do that. Do you see what I mean? That I can't think of the metaphor, but like a little child's game where something pops up and you press that down, another thing pops up and you press that down. You're just sort of scattering around your experience, trying to sort of press the self down in some weird way. So it's very straightforward. You just remember, you know, you just approach whatever's appearing to you most vividly, and the simplest places with your body, and you just very gently reflect that it's not me, it's not mine. I don't own it. I don't. It doesn't belong to me. Everything is going to be given back. And then you just keep coming back to working on that view rather than trying to get experiences from that view. Actually, this whole question of experiencing non-self gets a bit, it's a bit confused, really. What you're trying to do is practice this way of seeing. You're not trying to get experiences through this way of seeing. You're just practicing, remembering that none of your experience belongs to you. Because that's trying to be a whole life practice of gradually letting go of grasping and clinging. That gets mixed up with, can I have some spooky experiences of non-self? Which might be fine if they come up. But strangely, people can cling to that as well. So you're just trying to keep on bringing the view to bear on your experience. And this course is not just in the shrine room, but in the silence as you eat, things don't belong to you. Of course, really, the first sign that that's working is that you give more. You just give more, I would imagine, because things don't belong to you, so you just sort of give. So just trust the view. Be patient with it. Patiently keep coming back to it. I mean, that's what I found this morning, that I needed to be really patient, not try and grab at, is this working or not? Am I getting anywhere with this or not? Be patient. Trust that the view is what you're trying to practice. You're trying to practice bringing this view to bear on your experience. Because if you haven't got that view on your experience, you've got some other kind of view on your experience. Probably a not Buddhist view on your experience. And you can work between, what I was doing this morning is working between bringing the anatta reflection in, and then I notice as soon as I get tight a bit, I'd go back to trying to cultivate samadhi again. Just let me just watch out for any tightening, any subtle gripping. So let's just go back to just enjoying being in the body again. It's very strangely easy to get slightly conceited with these practices, just because we call them, they get called insight practice or vipassana practice. Somehow even the word vipassana gets to be in italics, whereas samatha is just like, oh yes. But you know, weirdly it gets hierarchical. Actually you need the both. You really need that stillness, calm, flexibility, happiness of samatha, and you need the cooler colours of pranya. You need the both. We don't need to think of them hierarchically, either that you need all, you know, you need to completely build up samatha before you can even think of vipassana, or once you get into vipassana reflection, sort of samatha work is kind of secondary and a bit sort of beginnery. People get slightly contemptuous of samatha, which is a bit odd, really. You just need the both. It's an argument based in nothing. You need a happy, mature, integrated, harmonious psyche. Not only do you need it, but good heavens, we want it. And to foster that and deepen that, we need to bring in insight reflections. The two go in tandem, and one can only deepen. Well, I'm experiencing a bit that one deepens if the other deepens. They kind of deepen each other. You know? So watch out for a sort of subtle conceit, which can creep in, I think, very easily with so-called insight practices, as if you're doing a special kind of practice. Other people aren't doing a special kind of practice. Poor little worldlings. Caricaturing it like that is a caricature. But I noticed even in my meditation this morning, a slight conceit about, but now I'm doing the grown-up thing. And you see how that can slip in without you noticing. And of course that's getting in a bus and going in the opposite direction of vipassana. So notice any sort of very subtle conceit that you're rather pleased with yourself for doing this practice. Fine to be pleased with about it, but then just remember that too is anatta, that's illusion as well, just let that go. But try to notice it. Strangely, it seems to creep in, probably with our Western kind of sense of now we're being promoted, now we're finally getting somewhere, you know, with a slight sort of very subtle conceit can come in. Conceit goes very deep for us human beings. Just when we think we're not conceited in one way, we manage to be conceited in another. Just when you stop being a snob, you become an anti-snob, which is a kind of snobbery, you know. It really is. You can't eradicate conceit. There has to be a massive whole new vision to overcome it. So that's another thing to watch. So watch out for subtle conceit. Watch out for looking out for subtle aversion. You're not trying to get rid of the self, remember. You're not trying to say it doesn't exist. It's some metaphysical point, you know, that you're just like a ghost or something, or a dream, or other people are a dream inside your dream. That's really just aversion. It's a subtle, very subtle aversion of trying to get rid of things. I think with all of these practices, very easy to slip over without noticing it into a subtle aversion of trying to get rid of things, trying to get rid of the self. That often happens when you try and get, you know, you notice your body and you think, okay, that's not myself. Then you think, oh, but hang on, I'm identifying with the witnesser watching me doing that. So you like run off and then try and get rid of that self. So you end up trying to sort of get rid of the self everywhere. And that's what causes the agitation. You're not trying to get rid of a self. You're not even trying to have self disappear or dissolve. That's not so important either. You're just trying to bring this reflection to life and keep bringing it to reflection to life. This reflection to life. So look out for subtle aversion. Because everything is anatta, then it can just be there. You don't need to get rid of it. If there's nothing substantial there, there's nothing to get rid of, if you know what I mean. So all you're trying to do is just notice that you have this belief in something substantial, And you just think, well, it's just not. It's not. Let me just... Is it substantial? Can I feel... Does it... It seems to be changing. You try to notice that. Yeah. So notice subtle aversion. Again, keep on monitoring for that. And it can be very subtle indeed and be disguised as anatta. Which is basically becomes the goal to getting rid of self in some way. And again, notice for subtle clinging, subtle grasping again, including onto, I'm rather pleased that I'm doing this practice, you know, notice any kind of subtle grasping onto it. What you're trying to do, you just keep bringing this, really go into the direct experience, you know, perhaps start with your body, Vedana, then go into Vedana, then go into noticing sounds, thoughts, emotions, even yourself doing the practice, you doing the, oh, it's going well, bring it to that, oh, it's not going well, bring it to that. Just keep bringing the view to the phenomena. And really you're looking out for any sense of relief and release. Yeah? That's always in these practices what you're doing, is looking for a sense of release, of an opening of freedom. You're not looking to get rid of anything. You're looking for this new consciousness, which is characterized by release, and you feel that release. And you can enjoy that release. Yeah. If you want to, like I had it today, just at the end of the practice, I had this lovely experience of, I suppose, release. I don't know what it was quite. I don't really care what it was. Seemed to slightly be Padmasambhava, but I'm not sure about that either. So I just thought, oh, I'll just enjoy that for a bit. And I could just sit in it and rest in it more. Basically, probably I was going back over into a samatha approach of just letting that pleasant sense of relief flood through the body. It's not quite like that when you do it in the meditation. You don't think, okay, press S for samatha. You go. All of these are just metaphors that we talk about. It's never quite like any of this when you actually do it. And I just sort of, yeah, you just experience the pleasure of being of the release. So look, keep looking for that. Keep looking for this. I mean, don't look too hard, but because that becomes an, you end up caveating after caveating. Keep looking for a sense of relief, and enjoying that, settling into that, and then bringing the, either going back over into the samatha, or bringing the anatta reflection to that sense of relief. Even that isn't mine, and that actually can open it out more. That sense of pleasure isn't mine, so that can. So I don't need to grasp it then, and it can actually be itself more. Yeah. So yes, look for subtle conceit, particularly about the practices, weirdly, which the very things that we're using to help us free ourselves from egotism can weirdly become another basis for egotism. So look out for that subtle sense of conceit. You can usually tell because you're rather proud of yourself in a slight, quiet, tucked away kind of way. If you're English, you'll be proud of yourself in a very quiet background kind of way, because the English aren't allowed to be proud of themselves. So look out for that. Look out for subtle aversion. Look out for subtle clinging again. And work gently in the practice. By gentleness, I was talking to Adam the other day about gentleness. I think the word gentleness is much used and much abused. I know very few people who I would describe as gentle, and none of those people are the people that talk about being gentle. It's a very rare quality, genuine gentleness. It's to do with being able to go into the unpleasant, the difficult, the jagged, without reacting at all. The gentleness that's imagined as Tara is a transcendental thing. It's, most of us aren't strong enough to be gentle. It's too demanding to be genuinely gentle, to be able to go into everything and touch it without any kind of aversion, any kind of wishing it was otherwise or grasping the bit we like. Gentleness is mostly beyond us, but we can try to be gentle, which is nothing to do with being soppy and all that kind of stuff, which is just horrible. Then the last thing I wanted to say is the value of reaction. Of course, what you might find in the meditation is you go back into prapuncha, surprise, surprise, and you start ruminating over something that you're reacting about. Either that because you want it, you're reacting in the sense that you want something, or you're reacting against something. And that's a really good thing to bring into this practice, because there's lots of layers of padding between our naked egotism and our belief in ourself. And you can think in this practice, I'm really doing well with this non-self stuff, until you think of, I don't know, your partner's just gone off with somebody else, or you've just lost a lot of money, or one of those reactive things, or you suddenly think of someone that you're very critical of. Suddenly, the thing that we thought was thinning very nicely, thank you, is there in a massive storm. So again, try and practice what Subhuti calls reaction practice, where you try and drop out of the narrative but really hold the feeling of reaction. Try to stay in touch with whether it's anger, lust, indignation, whatever it is. Try and hold it long enough and then try and find a self in it. What is it that you're trying to protect? Subhuti talks about using reaction as a kind of borehole into your naked egotism. So easy in our very pampered postmodern, post-industrial lives to not notice what a storm self is, if you know what I mean. It's very easy to think it's just a matter of technical delicacy to get rid of it or to overcome it. It's only when you start reacting that you really see right down into the depth of how much self-clinging there is. And that gives you a chance to actually work much more directly on the rock face of egotism, because you feel it flare up. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, apparently they used to go and just stand in a market, in a busy marketplace, and let themselves get knocked. And every time people knock into you, that flaring up of egotism, that's what you're trying to get in touch with, that flaring up of egotism. I think it's a bit like in the metta, when you do the difficult person, sometimes you can just think, oh yes, they're not so bad, they're that nice thing and that nice thing. You get this nice, lovely feeling, and then you go and meet them, and then they disagree with you again, and it's all back. And you sort of wonder whether you'd been working with it at all, whether you'd just been thinking of them in a slightly fantastical, flimsy kind of soppy way. Actually, you're trying to get to that aversion, that full aversive state, not some sort of sweetness on top of it. So cherish the reaction and try and use it as a borehole, whether it's anxiety about something in the future, regret about something in the past that you can't get over, fear, all those stronger reactive emotions that are protecting our egotism. That's your chance to see right down beneath all these layers of padding that we put between egotism and our behaviour into the thing itself, and then try and see what's going on here. Really try and investigate that with this view. That's when it'll really start to have some real life value. Yeah, so reaction practice. It's particularly valuable, that is a particularly valuable practice in life. When do you react? You train yourself to catch the reaction, keep the reaction in play long enough to actually work on it in this way. Yeah. I think that's all I've got to say. Any questions? It's all perfectly simple.
I found out that for me it's more helpful to think not that's not me, that's not mine, but more like I don't have to identify with it.
Right.
I don't have to think this. So is it in the sense you're teaching it?
Yes, it is.
Put
I think
it this way.
That you don't need to use those particular words, but yes, the issue is not is disidentifying. I don't need to identify with the body. And again, when you're reacting, sometimes you can get a sense, I actually don't need to react. I'm just sort of boiling over. You can feel yourself boil up, but sometimes you can even think, I don't actually need to do that. So, yes, you find ways that help you. Sometimes it's the language that you use helps you, you know. All you need to know is that you're disidentifying from ownership. Mm-hmm. However you do that, you know. Yes, but I think that's a good approach.
Not too much questions, a couple of points to do with Shamatha Vipassana. Jolene, who's on our refuge tree, says that Shamatha and Vipassana should be perfectly blended. And Bhante's commentary on that is that if you have Shamatha and Vipassana blended, it means you have a penetrating insight, but that it, because of the shamatha, it doesn't wound. It doesn't wound you, and it doesn't wound others. Because of the metta and the calm and so on. So I think that's a really lovely way of.
Yeah, very
if
nice.
If it's wounding, if it's damaging, if it's the shamatha is sort of lacking. And the other thing about when you were talking, I need to keep in mind the aim of the reflection on what's happened. It's just when you were talking about this is not mine, I think, and what came to mind was that lecture on enlightenment is experience and is non-experience, where Bhante talks about what would enlightenment is non-experience look like, and he talks about three things: growth, work, and duty.
That's
what it looks like, and he does this wonderful evocation of the Buddhist life is really like an abundance of lotuses growing in space. the vision of not self is one of, I take that to mean, of just unending growth and creativity. And it's not one thing.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I must recommend that Enlightenment of Experience and Non-Experience. I reread it in Gikiloka. It's incredibly prescient about a lot of the things that many people are discussing. Bhante's already thought about. It's a wonderful lecture. Do revisit it if you haven't. Fantastic, isn't it?
So, what was that?
It's called Enlightenment as Experience and Non-Experience. But yeah, do. I can't remember. It's in a booklet.
The Taste of Freedom.
The Taste of Freedom. Yes. It's very important. It's suddenly become rereading it now. It's incredible how Bhante's thought. Right into the future.
The question that came up just from reading these memoirs this morning. He's talking about Anapanasati and levels of dhyana, and I read it a couple times, couldn't quite work out what he was saying. He said it was really important that one pointedness would be there in the lower levels and then disappear in the higher levels, but then you could come back to that one point and start. I don't know if it's related to anything to do, but it seemed to be important to him at the time.
I'll have to look at the section, but you know, again, he might be saying just what, you know, Pamavadra says is important, of blending the two. You've got to have some degree of concentration, haven't you? Otherwise you can't even hold the reflection. I'd have to have a look at it. I mean, it's interesting you mentioning the Bhante's memoirs, because another way I found of, in a certain sense, bringing into this reflection was when I was at Gukiloka every night, I reread three of the memoirs, I think. And rereading them in those conditions, I felt in touch with another kind of consciousness, that Bhante's constantly hinting all the way through it of another kind of way of being in the world. And that really fed into my meditations. I was reading something last night that William James had said, the brother of Henry James, he was saying that faith is often faith in another person's faith, which I was really struck by. And that's one of the, for me, that's been one of the reasons why Bhante is so important to me, is I have faith in his faith. You know what I mean? And I had direct contact with that faith through reading the memoirs. Okay, don't have much to add for this second meditation. What I would like to start to do now is to start to put it all together. So, see if you can carry on with that reflection. Go first of all again, cultivating samatha, starting to go into the anatta reflection, and then see if you can go from that anatta reflection into either sadhana, if you've got a sadhana, or into buddhana smriti, or just into finding your way towards the greatly desired deity. So start to see how spiritual death opens space for some new consciousness to arise, which we can imagine as the Buddha or as the Bodhisattva. So starting to get a sense of this whole arc of sadhana. Remembering to work with the terrain of your mind, what's happening, working appropriately with that